Welcome to Let's Talk About Obesity Care, a podcast series from Let's Go. The series is focused on thought-provoking and informative conversations to support medical providers interested in obesity prevention and treatment. I'm your host, Carrie Gordon, a pediatric nephrologist turned childhood obesity treatment physician. I am a clinical advisor to Let's Go, a childhood obesity prevention program of the Barbara Bush Children's Hospital, and a practicing specialist at Maine Medical Center's Weight and Wellness Program in lovely Portland, Maine. Today, we're joined by Dr. Abby Fleisch to discuss polycystic ovarian syndrome. Abby is a pediatric endocrinologist at the Maine Health Medical Group, whose work is a combination of research and clinical practice. Abby, it's so nice of you to join us.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, why don't we start by discussing polycystic ovarian syndrome? It's more of its importance in the big picture, why we don't want to miss the diagnosis.
We don't want to miss the diagnosis because PCOS has a variety of health considerations that are linked to it. So most physicians are aware of the increased risk of infertility and also of the typical obesity-related comorbidities. So people with PCOS are at increased risk also of type 2 diabetes, heart disease, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, sleep apnea, and also for mood disorders like depression. I think physicians are generally a little bit less aware of the link between PCOS and the increased risk of endometrial cancer. So, for example, there was a recent meta-analysis that showed a 3 times increased risk. And that increased risk of endometrial cancer is thought to be due to the unopposed estrogen action in the setting of hyperandrogenism and the prolonged anovulatory state. So these are some important reasons why it's important to identify people with PCOS.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, that was something probably I wasn't as well versed in until I transitioned into doing all obesity care and really understanding the importance of getting that menstrual cycle regulated again to help minimize that risk.
Of course, there's also the cosmetic challenges that patients face. So things like acne and hirsutism, and then just the having irregular menses and being able to provide treatments that could help to improve those things is another reason why we don't want to miss the diagnosis of PCOS.
Yeah. When you're an adolescent girl, you know, in high school and not knowing when you're going to get your period, not being prepared and all that obviously is problematic in and of itself.
Definitely.
Well, you know, the 2023 AAP clinical practice guidelines mentions some of the challenges with the diagnostic criteria, making that diagnosis in adolescents who can already have kind of a regular menses when it's first starting. Maybe want to review the diagnostic criteria for PCOS and which lab tests you guys do as endocrinology?
Yeah, sure. So PCOS has, as I think you mentioned, a variety of societal guidelines for its diagnosis. So different societies have different criteria, and that can be kind of confusing. I'm an endocrinologist, so I follow the Endocrine Society guidelines, and they recommend using the 2003 Rotterdam criteria for adults. So the Endocrine Society recommends diagnosing PCOS in adults who have 2 of the following 3 things: clinical or biochemical hyperandrogenism, that's the first one. The second one is irregular menses. And the third is having polycystic ovaries on the ultrasound. The thing is that polycystic ovaries on ultrasound are pretty common, even in individuals without PCOS. And having polycystic ovaries on your ultrasound is particularly common in adolescents. So we do something modified in pediatrics. In adolescents, we're diagnosing PCOS if the teens have both of the following 2 things. So clinical and biochemical hyperandrogenism is the first one, and the second is irregular menses. We don't use that ultrasound criteria. Also, to make the diagnosis of PCOS, we have to have excluded other medical conditions. And I'm happy to break this down a little more if you'd like.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, great. So when we're looking for evidence of clinical hyperandrogenism, that's the presence, we would define that as the presence of moderate to severe inflammatory acne, so over 10 facial lesions that are unresponsive to topical prescriptions, or moderate to severe hirsutism, and we would define that based on the Ferriman-Galway score, or having an elevated free testosterone level above the adult normal range. So any of those things would make a person meet the criteria of having clinical or biochemical hyperandrogenism. And then as far as figuring out if someone has irregular menses, so we would define that as any menstrual cycle length that's less than 19 or greater than 90 days. Or if you're having a long duration, so over 2 years of menses that are less than 21 days or greater than 45 days, we would consider that to meet the criteria for irregular menses. But there's some nuance to that for teenagers. So it's normal to have anovulation in the 2 years post-menarche. So we consider individuals who are still 2 years post-menarche, but are starting to meet the PCOS criteria to be in a kind of designation where we would say they're at risk for PCOS. We'd wait until they're over 2 years post-menarche to officially make the diagnosis. I mentioned to make the diagnosis of PCOS, we also have to rule out other medical conditions that could cause irregular menses or hyperandrogenism. And so we would send the free testosterone to look for biochemical hyperandrogenism, but then there's a number of other labs that we would send to rule out the other medical conditions. So those would include a DHEAS, a total testosterone, a morning 17-OHP, a prolactin, thyroid function test, and a pregnancy test. I'll also often send gonadotropins and estradiol, depending on the clinical situation. I don't do a pelvic ultrasound for the reasons we just discussed. And if the patient's BMI is greater than the 95th percentile, I may also send the typical pediatric obesity screening labs, so an A1C, fasting lipids, ALT. And if I haven't sent those labs at the first pass, but the workup suggests PCOS, then I'll send a hemoglobin A1C and often a fasting insulin to evaluate for insulin resistance.
This is really helpful. It's interesting, you know, working in an obesity program where we also have an adult practice, you know, the adult workup is different. They don't do all the, you know, hormonal labs. And I think, you know, it's still important in pediatrics. Obviously, we don't want to miss anything else that could be going on. I have also had patients with PCOS who had a delayed start to their menses. So they're not getting their period and they're, you know, 15 years old. And I don't know if that's something you guys see relatively commonly and well in endo.
Me too. Yeah, I do think we see that. Probably it's not the majority of our PCOS patients, but we definitely see people with primary amenorrhea whose labs suggest PCOS.
Well, you know, this is a podcast focused around obesity, but you did bring up that, you know, not all patients who you see who have PCOS have obesity. Is the workup or treatment of the condition any different if a patient has obesity or doesn't have obesity?
Yeah, so that's definitely true. We see patients with PCOS who don't have obesity. I don't think the workup is necessarily different, but I would point out that the excess weight in patients who have PCOS plus obesity is thought to amplify the adverse metabolic outcomes in PCOS. So those patients tend to have a more severe phenotype than patients with PCOS who are carrying less weight. So in adult patients in particular, there have been studies. So in those patients with PCOS and obesity, treating the obesity through lifestyle modification, weight-reducing medications, or bariatric surgery has been shown to be effective in decreasing their hyperandrogenism and hyperinsulinism and in resuming spontaneous ovulation and fertility. So I definitely think for patients who have both PCOS and obesity, tackling treatments for both conditions is helpful for PCOS.
Well, that's really consistent with the AAP-CPG, you know, talking about treating our comorbidities and treating obesity at the same time. And I think it's great you brought it up. You know, it's interesting because BMI is not a direct measure of adiposity. And it may well also be the case that some of the individuals who have a healthy BMI may have, you know, increased adiposity as part of what's going on with their PCOS.
Yeah, I definitely think that people with PCOS, even those who are not carrying extra weight, still can have increased, especially visceral central fat mass when they're compared to their age and BMI match controls. So that distribution of fat, even if their BMI isn't elevated, can predispose to adverse metabolic health. And that's even in the PCOS patients without obesity.
Abby, one thing we haven't covered yet is the pathophysiology of what's actually happening with PCOS.
I would say that while PCOS is super common, it occurs in about 5 to 10% of women. The cause is, and the pathophysiology is beginning to be understood, and we can talk about that a little. The cause of PCOS is really not completely understood. It's important to appreciate that PCOS is a syndrome, so it's not a straight disease, and it has multiple potential causes. We think that there is a genetic predisposition, but that there are also contributions from environmental factors. So would it be helpful for me to speak a little bit about the cause, and then I can also talk about the pathophysiology?
That'd be great.
We think, as far as the cause, we think PCOS occurs from two hits. So that people may have a congenitally programmed predisposition or first hit, but that the syndrome only becomes manifest in the presence of a second hit. And the first hit could be a genetic predisposition, so changes in genes that affect ovarian function or that predispose to obesity and insulin resistance. And the second hit usually is the insulin resistance and hyperinsulinism that might be genetic or could be acquired postnatally in the setting of obesity. And I do environmental health research, and there's even some emerging research that environmental endocrine disrupting chemicals such as BPA or PFAS may play a role. When we think about the pathophysiology of PCOS, it's really a hormonal, a kind of vicious hormonal cycle. So functional ovarian hyperandrogenism from abnormal ovarian steroidogenesis, again, perhaps from that, you know, genetic first hit, is usually the major source of the androgen excess. And it can account for the major features of the syndrome. So the hirsutism, the acne, the anovulation. In some patients, insulin resistance, concurrent insulin resistance, leads to hyperinsulinism. Those high levels of insulin can act on the theca cells to aggravate the hyperandrogenism. And the insulin can work together with the androgens to actually stimulate additional fat accumulation. Also, the elevated androgens increase LH levels, which can worsen the hyperandrogenism and stimulate the secretion of estradiol, which suppresses FSH and then further exacerbates the polycystic ovarian morphology and further suppresses ovulation. So it's really kind of like a hormonal cycle where ovarian hyperandrogenism and the insulin resistance act together to exacerbate each other.
Well, it's really important that we break those patterns. That's, things combining to make the whole process worse for patients, you know, can set them back. And so it's great to have that understanding and make sure that, you know, we do something to help break that cycle and normalize these hormonal patterns. Maybe we should talk a little bit about treatment. I know there's, you know, different medications that we could use for some of the different problems that people who have PCOS might have. I guess starting off with like regulating the periods, what are some of the things you use to help regulate the periods?
Yeah, sure. I would just start by saying that when I see patients with PCOS, I always try to explain that there are multiple treatment options. And then the discussion, the clinic visit winds up being talking through which options might be best for that particular patient and giving the family and the patient some information so that they can really help to tailor the treatment to what will work best for them. And the treatment options really vary depending on the primary issue. So for some patients, the primary issue is irregular menses, which is what you are directly asking about. In other patients, the primary issue is hirsutism and acne, or in others, the primary issue is insulin resistance and diabetes. So I think in many, sometimes people have all of these or a combination. And so figuring out which treatment to pull from the arsenal, I think depends on that presentation. And as for irregular menses, patients with PCOS who have irregular menses require some hormonal treatment for endometrial protection. So we want them to be shedding their endometrial lining regularly to decrease the future risk of endometrial cancer. I recommend orthocycline as the OCP of choice because it has enough estrogen and a non-androgenic progestin. Another option is cyclic Provera or cyclic micronized progestin courses without any extra estrogen, and that will also help with endometrial protection. And physical activity, encouraging physical activity, that can also improve ovulation and menstrual frequency in addition to improving mood.
It's interesting because, you know, when I always prepare for the podcasts and, you know, and tend to look up things in a little more depth than I may have already known. And I was reading about, because I sometimes start with metformin, which can also regulate periods. Yeah. And it reminded me that, you know, if the periods are not being regulated, even if the patient has had some weight loss with the metformin, really important to understand that that probably isn't decreasing their risk for endometrial cancer, and really also really trying to focus on, you know, that, like you said, regularly shedding the uterine lining so that we're not really having that increased risk for patients.
Yeah, for sure. That's definitely true. And patients with PCOS, I tend to think about metformin in the people who have insulin resistance. So if they have acanthosis, if they have an elevated A1C, if they have elevated fasting insulin, that's generally the patient in whom I'll talk about lifestyle modification, offer metformin, and depending on the severity of the insulin resistance and whether the patient actually has diabetes, I'd consider other insulin sensitizing agents. And depending on their BMI would also, like we just talked about earlier, consider weight-reducing agents or bariatric surgery.
And if hirsutism is the primary concern that the patient has, where do you head?
So if hirsutism is their primary concern, I would usually start by talking about non-hormonal treatment options, so hair removal methods or dermatologic treatments for acne. And then I'll also talk about hormonal treatment options. So the first line for hirsutism and acne is a less androgenic OCP, again, orthocycline. And if after 3 to 6 months, the orthocycline is ineffective in decreasing the hirsutism and acne, then we'll offer spironolactone, which is a potassium-sparing diuretic, and it's also an anti-androgen. And it's often very effective in improving acne and hirsutism in people with PCOS. The thing is about spironolactone is that it's teratogenic, so we always prescribe it after a patient is already taking an OCP, and we go over that risk with patients.
I'm not sure if you have had any of these patients, and maybe these patients end up in dermatology, but it feels like lately I've had patients with a combination of both the hirsutism from the hyperandrogenism and also some hair loss, you know, on their head where they want to have hair. So that combination of too much hair in one place and not enough hair in another place. Is that something that you've also seen in clinic?
That's an interesting question. I'm going to have to keep my eye out for it, but it hasn't been something that I've seen much.
Yeah. You know, I did look it up, you know, because I have lately, I've had like 3 patients, and I also sometimes have patients on bupropion, which of all the antidepressants can, you know, is the one that probably has the most risk of hair loss. But I did see some studies that looked at using a combination of, you know, low dose spironolactone with low dose minoxidil as a potential therapy to help, you know, with, you know, helping to normalize the hair growth. Interestingly, it seems like they probably need to be on the medications longer to get the effects of having the hair they want to grow back, as opposed to getting rid of some of the hirsutism. So not something I have a ton of experience with yet, but I, you know, this is probably also something we can send to dermatology.
Yeah, that's great to know. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, PCOS is definitely one of those comorbidities that has some real nuances to the care. And I really appreciate you bringing up also physical activity as something that can improve ovulation. We know obviously it can also improve mood. And you mentioned the connections of mood issues. You know, what I've looked at in terms of dietary interventions, it seems like maybe there's not much evidence that low carb is better than another form of like MyPlate or another form of approach if the weight loss results are similar, that it's sort of more the weight than it is potentially the content of the diet. I don't know. Are you guys recommending specific diets for someone who has PCOS?
So I've seen those data that you described too in adults. I have not personally been recommending any particular diet for PCOS.
I suppose that might vary a little if they have type 2 diabetes too, because
you might absolutely. I think that's a good point. If they have insulin resistance and you're going down that treatment route, then I would think about lower carb.
Well, you know, thanks so much for talking with us about PCOS. I think it's just so important that we recognize not only the inconvenience that this might place for the patients without being able to predict their periods and also maybe some of the cosmetic changes, but also some of these other long-term health risks that are, you know, really important that our patients are aware of, because sometimes those are the steps they need to understand in order to be really interested in taking therapy or maybe making a change in physical activity or something to try to help minimize those long-term risks.
Yes, it's been great to be able to speak with you about it.
Thanks for listening to Let's Talk About Obesity Care. You can find all of our episodes on your podcast app and on our webpage, letsgo.org. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, we'd really love to hear from you. please email us at info@letsgo.org. Let's Talk About Obesity Care is produced by Let's Go. Thanks so much for joining us.